Time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Linda Frank. Linda Frank is a member of Last March's Code Pink Women for Peace's International Women's Day delegation to Gaza, and she is in here to talk about the recent history and the current situation in Gaza. Linda, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you very much for inviting me here.
Start out and tell us briefly, how did you get involved with the issue of Palestine and Israel?
I had been a student of Judaism in the mid-1990s, and after 9/11, I'm a native New Yorker, and like many, many Americans, and especially New Yorkers, I was horrified by the events of 9/11. And I, my response to 9/11 was actually to consider joining the reserves. Till I learned that I was not age ready, a little older than they might have liked. But I was intrigued when Rudy Giuliani, was the then mayor of New York, was offered some millions of dollars in reconstruction funds for New York City. And if he would only acknowledge that Israel's maltreatment of the Palestinians was at least a partial motivation for the events of 9/11. And so when Giuliani refused that money, I was intrigued to finally learn what was happening in that part of the world. When I studied at Temple in the mid-1990s, Israel really wasn't talked about much. So I knew very little, and I was a very apolitical person. I didn't really read the newspapers. I wasn't up on current events. So I had very little understanding of global events, and especially in that part of the world, what was happening. So I called the local newspaper and asked if they would write a primer about Israel, and I didn't even know to say Palestine or Palestinians. And they declined, and but called me the next day and said that a Jewish American and a Palestinian American would be speaking in my area and gave me their phone numbers. So I felt much more connected to the Jewish American, and I went over and talked with him, and he loaded me up with materials, and that was the beginning of my education. And when I realized what the Israeli government was doing to the Palestinians, I felt so compelled to be a part of a solution. And so I took 15 months sabbatical. I had contemplated joining the Peace Corps at some point in my life. And so I thought, well, this is an ideal opportunity for me. It's an area of passion. And I'm not getting on a plane and going to Africa, but I can go out to my office and work on the computer. And I started networking with people in Israel. I started networking with people in the United States, mostly Jewish American groups, but also some generalized American group, you know, people who were interested in human rights, and got engaged. I started to realize if Congress knew what was really happening, they would change their policy. If the American people really knew what was happening, they would stand behind a call for justice, for a just peace, not just peace. And if the media would cover the situation differently, that we would have a very different outcome. And we would have had peace in the Middle East long before now. I mean, there is a solution that's on the table that we just can't get to, in part because of our Congress, in part because of our media coverage, and in part because of a public that is not very well informed.
All right, so tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of the Israel's attack on Gaza. Can you kind of, again, briefly, give us some history of the situation in Gaza leading up to the one year ago from tomorrow?
Mm-hmm. Gaza, 70% of the population of Gaza are refugees or their descendants from the war of 1948. So, and more than half of the population of Gaza are children. And they have lived in, without many human rights and without their freedom, for decades. In 1967, Israel occupied Gaza, as well as the West Bank and East Jerusalem. They later annexed East Jerusalem, but most of the world doesn't consider East Jerusalem part of Israel because under international law, you cannot simply conquer a territory in war and make it your own. You have to negotiate it. So Gaza has been occupied since 1967, a military occupation. It's the longest military occupation in the history of the world. So Palestinians have not had the freedoms and many of the human rights that certainly that we enjoy in the United States and that many people around the world enjoy. Many people think that when Israel pulled its settlers and the soldiers protecting them out of Gaza in 2005, that Gazans got their freedom. You consistently hear, look, Israel pulled out, gave Gaza their freedom, and what did they do? They sent off rockets. They just shot rockets off. Well, the missing piece of that story is that the occupation never ended. Although the settlers, and those were illegal settlers, under international law, you cannot move your own people into occupied territory. So they were illegal settlers. But when they were pulled out, Israel maintained control over Gaza's borders. And so under international law, that qualified them to continue to be an occupying force. So when people say Hamas has control over Gaza, no, they don't. They have control inside Gaza, but they don't have control over Gaza's borders. So they can't control the movement of people. They can't control the movement of goods. They are a sealed-off territory. They are literally sealed off from the world. When Hamas won the elections, and that the U.S., to cut a long story short, but the U.S. forced elections on the Palestinians, and the people of Fatah, which was Arafat's party, said, don't do it, because we were not included in that disengagement from Gaza when Israel disengaged, when they pulled out, which, by the way, the senior advisor to then Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, the senior advisor, Dov Weisglass, considered that disengagement to be, and I quote, formaldehyde to the peace process. So Israel was not being generous in giving Gaza their freedom. They were pulling out of Gaza, which meant that then Gaza was open territory to pummel, to do these sonic booms. They would fly over and do and break the sound barrier, causing deafness and hearing difficulties in a lot of the children. Israel made regular incursions into Gaza, killing, doing these targeted, what they call targeted assassinations. So drones, unmanned drones, would come and target a car carrying a Hamas official. And they used to be careful that they only took out the militant that they were targeting. Then, because they were able to kill with such impunity, they started to take these targeted assassinations and kill civilians alongside, civilian bystanders. Or remember that one-ton bomb that dropped on the home of a Hamas official, killing 14 members of their family and some of their neighbors. So Gaza was literally like a shooting target. And then when Hamas routed out Fatah, as we hear it in the news, in 2007, Israel put a punishing siege on the Palestinians. And again, Dov Weisglass, who called the disengagement formaldehyde to the peace process, he said, we'll put a siege on them. It'll be like sending Palestinians to a dietitian. We won't quite starve them, but we'll make them very hungry. And so they started to reduce the amount of humanitarian aid to 15 to 20% of what's needed for minimal survival. So for almost 2 years before the attack of last December, Palestinians were living with 15 to 20% of the goods that they needed to live a decent life. If that's not enough to make somebody shoot off a rocket occasionally, you know, and again, I don't justify targeting civilians. I think that targeting civilians is wrong in all cases, but I think if we're going to condemn the targeting of civilians by these rockets from Hamas, which don't have explosives on the end of them, by the way. They come through a roof and truly would be an instrument of terror. I wouldn't want to live with the possibility of one of them coming through my roof. But to compare those rockets and to condemn those rockets as being so terrible without condemning what the Israeli military is doing. The Israeli military is the fourth largest military in the world. We're talking about the most advanced weaponry in the world, also targeting civilians. It's just that you can't call it terrorism because they're a state. And the states write the rules as to what the definition of terrorism is. But to have a civilian population consistently being barraged with F-16s and Apache helicopters and the violence of a siege, of reducing humanitarian aid, of medical supplies and food down to 15 to 20%, I think we need to expand our definition of what violence is. It's not just simply killing someone. You can be killing someone slowly. You don't need to put a bullet through their heart or their head in order to kill them. So Gazans have been living under the direst of circumstances for many, many, many years, and for 2 years before the assault, they were living under siege. They also are not permitted out of Gaza. So Israel's assault last December was like shooting fish in a fishbowl and with an elephant gun. I mean, again, with the most advanced weaponry made and paid for by the United States taxpayers. The jet fuel. George Bush and the American military gave Israel that jet fuel, that flew those jets that dropped those bombs on a captive civilian population. And if you read the human rights reports, consistently they say this was a targeting of a civilian population. This is collective punishment. These are war crimes. These are crimes against humanity. It wasn't just the Goldstone Report, which our U.S. Congress shamefully tried to bury and discredit one of the finest jurists and human rights advocates, Richard Goldstone, in the world. A man who has fought for human rights in multiple places around the globe. But so it's not just the Goldstone Report that wanted a reporting of war crimes, wanted an investigation into war crimes, which they called for from Hamas as well as from Israel. And Hamas actually said that they would do their own investigation, but Israel to date has not promised to do that. So what happened last December was not something that was done in self-defense. Israel had long planned the assault on Gaza, and actually by Israel's own admission on their military websites, the ceasefire was working. Israel and Hamas had entered into a ceasefire in June of 2008, and that was to be from June to December. Israel broke the ceasefire from the get-go. They tried to say that Hamas broke the ceasefire, but Israel never raised the aid level from over 15 or 20%, and that was part of the terms of the ceasefire. And then on November 4th, our election day, when the world was looking at Barack Obama and what was happening in the United States, Israel crossed over into Gaza and killed 6 Palestinians. And that's when Hamas said, nope, we're going to shoot up some rockets again. I mean, I don't know what Hamas said, but that was the result of it. And so all this provocation by Israel, at what point do we say, how much do we expect human beings to take, how much abuse and terror in their own lives? So, I mean, I'm not excusing it, I'm just explaining that these are the course of circumstances that we don't get to hear about in the United States. We only get to hear that they shot rockets.
Right, and as you pointed out there on Israeli website, is it Department of Defense, or they have actual graphs showing the number of Hamas rocket attacks, and that had gone down for that given month. They're down to single digits.
They were down to single digits.
They were still occurring.
And they even found, even by the Israeli military's own admission, some of those rockets were shot off by Fatah. By the way, Fatah, you know, we hear that Hamas threw Fatah out of Gaza. The U.S. was training Fatah forces in Egypt and maybe elsewhere, but they came back into Gaza with this. The story is told in Vanity Fair. I think David Rose is the author of the article. It's called The Gaza Bombshell, and talks about how Fatah forces came back with these new weapons and these SUVs with dark windows and these brand new uniforms, and there was a coup that was being planned to push Hamas out of Gaza, so Hamas just got the better of him and said, you know, okay, something's going on. You know, where are these new weapons coming from, these brand new SUVs and all these uniforms? So that's kind of the origin of Hamas routing Fatah out of Gaza. And there were terrible human rights abuses. I sat with a Hamas parliamentarian in Gaza, a woman who would think that Hamas has a quota for women. You know, I want to emphasize this because we've made Hamas into such a boogeyman, and there is such a wide spectrum within Hamas, just like there is in the Democratic Party. You have everyone from Joe Lieberman, a so-called Democrat, you know, to the Dennis Kuciniches and the more liberal Democrats, the whole spectrum. So I sat with this female Hamas parliamentarian who ran a runs an all-woman PR firm. And she said when the Fatah forces pulled out or were routed out by Hamas, there was this terrible security vacuum. And all these, it's my word, yahoos, you know, these Hamas figures who had been so terribly oppressed and really kept under the boot of Fatah and of Israel and had no, you know, it's hard for us here in the United States to imagine what it's like to not have control over a lot of your life. But they kind of went crazy, and there were a lot of human rights abuses. And she would take the human rights reports to the Prime Minister, Ismail Haniyeh, and she said about 1,000 of members of those security forces were penalized, either their salaries reduced or otherwise penalized. And then they got training in place and sort of got it under control. So she explained a little bit of what we heard here, you know, of kneecaps being shot off and things like that. And that did happen, but because there was all of a sudden this security vacuum. But she said they're losing an entire generation now in Gaza, kids who saw that their parents could not protect them and will gravitate toward militants. And she said, we in Hamas are moderates. You know, and sure enough, later, several months later, there was a story that there was an Al-Qaeda cell that Hamas, there was a shootout in a mosque or something, so Hamas wanted them out of Gaza. They didn't want anything to do with an Al-Qaeda presence in Gaza. But the kids are gravitating toward the militants because they think that firepower is the only way for them to be protected. And Cindy and Craig Corey led a delegation, and they were on my delegation in March, and then they took a delegation of their own from the Rachel Corey Foundation in September, and Cindy Corey said it was really alarming, the number of kids running around with plastic guns.
So it was in early November that Israel made an invasion into Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
And
killed 6 Palestinians.
And then after that, then the Hamas rockets going back towards Israel ramped back up. And then end of December, the 27th, Israel does a full-blown invasion attack on Gaza. How long did that last? And we're running short on time, only about 12 minutes left. You also have you've worked on a diary of a woman there in Gaza. I'm wondering if you can include a piece of that in your response.
Sure, absolutely. Yes, Israel started dropping bombs at about 11:45 in the morning. It was the time of day when the school children, the early shift, were leaving the school and the late shift was coming to the school. The maximum number of people were on the streets. The bombing assault lasted, I think it was about a week, and then they started, or 5 days, and then they started a ground assault as well. Overall, it was about 3 weeks that they pummeled Gaza from the air, from tanks. And you mentioned the diary. I met a woman who was one of my translators, and she mentioned that she kept a diary every day of the assault. And I and my Gaza roommate, who's a Canadian-Israeli, Sandra Roos, Sandra and I asked if we could read the diary and perhaps make it public. And so I got several days of it and brought Seattle playwright Ed Mast into the process and asked if he would create a reading performance. Poets West was doing an event at the Seattle Library. So that diary, people can go and Google 7 days from a Gaza diary, and it's up on Huffington. There's an article on Huffington Post and an excerpt from the diary, and there's a link to the full text as well as to an audio version that if people prefer to listen to it rather than read it. But this is just the excerpt from the first day of the war, and this is from the diary of 27-year-old Khulud Ghanem. I finished my work in Khan Yunis at 10 o'clock and rode a car to Gaza City. I reached there at 11. I decided to drink some coffee with my friend who was working in a company beside the Legislative Council and the Academy for Police. I stayed there till 11:30. I decided to leave. My friend said to stay. It's early. I stayed for 15 minutes. At 11:45, I was on my way walking on the street. I heard the first rocket, the second, and the third, many quick attacks, one after the other. At this moment, I could see nothing. All I remember was the biggest explosion I have ever seen. I started to run away, but to where? I saw the military planes in the sky at a low level. I was scared. I started to lose consciousness. All I was thinking was how to reach a safe place. The sound of bombs and explosions was horrible. The ground was moving up and down. I said, it is not a joke. It is real. The war has started. During this short time, all roads have been closed. All streets have been overcrowded by the ambulances and emergency cars. I stopped beside a building, looking at the sky, watching the military planes. At that moment, I lost my ability to move or even to think. People, girls, and children, all were shouting, running everywhere. It was time for the students to leave their school. I thought that if they started to attack haphazardly, they will make a catastrophe. I reached Al Shefa Hospital. The roads had been closed to ease the movement of the ambulances. I decided to walk in another direction to reach any station, to ride a car to the south. I walked a lot till I felt sick. The attacks increased and the streets started to be empty from people, except the emergency and ambulance cars. I was worried about my family, sisters, brothers, friends. I tried to phone everyone I knew to assure that all are safe, but the attacks destroyed the telecommunication net. My journey to Khan Yunis took 3 hours. It was more safe to avoid the main street because most of the police stations that had been attacked were located at the main street. Finally, I reached home. All my family were sitting, glaring at the screen of the TV, shocked, pale, yellow, and horrible faces, sitting like idols. I took a place beside them. The first scene was for the police academy. The number of martyrs was big, about 180 in one place. The scene was horrible, really can't be described. Blood in every place, severed parts, heads, hands, legs, arms, couldn't be described. I spent my whole day sitting on a chair in front of the TV. I did not expect one day that I will face such a catastrophe. Hour after hour, numbers of martyrs increased and increased. At 8:30 this night, I had a call from my sister, who lived in Gaza City. She was walking beside the fence of that school. She saw the heads of young children, bags colored with their blood. One child, with his blue shirt, she taught him once before. He was thrown on the ground, bleeding from all parts, with no legs. He was shouting and raising his hands, but no one could help. She started to scream, "What should we do?" I kept silence and started to cry loudly. The vision was so hard to imagine. She started to lose her breath. I told her, "That is enough. Please stop talking. I can't tolerate." I closed my mobile and took my diary and sat in the living room. And interspersed with these remarkable first-person accounts of the assault are reports from the human rights organizations that, again, sort of corroborate from an objective perspective what Khulood is experiencing from her own personal subjective perspective. It's really quite a remarkable piece that Ed put together, and I hope people do get a chance to read it.
And again, she was a woman you worked with when you went on your delegation back in March of this year?
Yeah, she volunteered to be one of the translators.
And on your delegation, did you find her stories to be similar to others that you heard?
Yeah, I had been reading the stories before I left for Gaza. Stories mostly from B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization. They have a remarkable archive on their website of some of the stories, like the Simuni family, who I think 40 members of their family were killed. They were told to go into a particular building, and then as they tried to leave, the father came and opened the door, and he was shot promptly. In fact, Khulood tells a similar story, how the Israeli army called a family, friends of her sister's, and said, "Get out of the house, we're going to bomb the house." And the father decided to stay, but he put the mother and the girls, he forced them to leave to save their lives, and they put heavy coats on and took some money. And as they were leaving the house, the Apache helicopters fired on the mother and the daughters. I mean, consistently you hear story after story of civilians being deliberately targeted like this.
Only about 5 minutes left. So what has happened since the attack a year ago?
Not much of anything has happened. Tragically, here we are a year later, and reconstruction supplies have not been permitted into Gaza. Still, only 15 to 20% of foods. In September, 140 vital medications went on the extinct list. John Ging, who facilitates, he's the director of UNRWA, the UN Relief Works Agency. They care for the refugees in Gaza. And he said Israel won't even give him a list of the banned items. And so then they'll turn whole trucks around because there's one banned item on it. He said in one case, whole trucks got turned around because there was sugar substitute on it. Now imagine sugar substitute. When John Kerry and Brian Baird went to Gaza in April, I think it was, macaroni was on the banned list. When I got back from Gaza, tea and biscuits were on the banned list. So it's very fickle. There's a good story called, I think it's called Gaza Bonanza or something like that, and it's about how the items that are let into Gaza depend on which ones the Israeli farmers have more of that week. So it's a process that the UN can't keep up with, to identify which foods are, you know, they should load up on trucks and which foods not. Many trucks and medicines are sitting tarped on trucks out in the hot sun, and in fact Egypt just destroyed a large shipment of medicine because they had reached expiration date. So Gazans are still, many of them are living in the ruins of their homes. These are big concrete sheets of the roofs of their house, what was once the top floor of their house, that are hanging by pieces of rebar, and they are forced to live in them. The UN set up tent cities. So some are sleeping in tents, but the weather is very much like ours. So they're, in some cases, freezing temperatures, and these people are sleeping in tents. Very few, I think it's about 10% of the population don't have access to any fresh water. The water table has become so polluted in Gaza that a lot of salt is getting into the water, because Israel takes about 80% of the water. And so there's a lot of kidney problems now in Gaza, blue baby syndrome with nitrites in the water. So we need to end the siege of Gaza. And right now there are 1,300 delegates from 43 countries around the world. That Code Pink, one of the organizers of this Gaza Freedom March, are in Cairo right now asking the Egyptian government, let us into Gaza, to march shoulder to shoulder with 50,000 Palestinians that have organized to make a march a mile long up Gaza to the Israeli border. 50,000 Palestinians in a nonviolent call for an end to the siege of Gaza. Jimmy Carter says we can get materials in and let them reconstruct without getting them into the hands of Hamas, which is what Israel says is the reason that they want to keep materials out of Gaza. But it's criminal that 13 or 19 aid organizations, including Oxfam and Amnesty International, are saying the international community has failed Gaza because we have let the siege continue for a full year longer after the assault. And an already brutalized people are now in truly, truly dire circumstances.
All right. 2 minutes. What would you like listeners to do?
I would love for listeners, you could go to the Gaza freedommarch.org website and write a letter of support to the Egyptian government asking them to let the march into Gaza. You could go to, I think, looking at boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. If you go to the Palestine Solidarity website for Seattle, they have a good section there on what the boycott can do. It helped to end South African apartheid. Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Ronnie Castrels, all of South Africa say that the apartheid Palestinians are facing is far worse than the one that South Africans face. So let's help to end the apartheid, the occupation, and lift the siege of Gaza.
All right. And what is that website for the Seattle organization, Palestine?
You'll have to Google it. I don't know the exact. It's
PalestineInformation.org.
That sounds like it. Yeah.
All right. And that also has a link to the diary.
And that has a link to the diary as well, to 7 days from a Gaza diary.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me here. I appreciate it.
We have just been talking with Linda Frank. She is a member of last March's Code Pink Women for Peace International Women's Day delegation to Gaza. And again, you can find out more via the local Seattle website, palestineinformation.org.